Hello, welcome to News Club. I'm your host, Em, and this is where we talk about the news and what to do about it. Today, I'm joined by Bea and Chivers, who is back from last week's absence. So, yeah, we'll be diving into council elections. So fascinating, so interesting, so captivating.
Hey.
And then we'll be addressing a little something on anti-woke, on wokeness, on I'm not too sure what, actually, but we will figure it out. We will see. There's a lot to be said, but I will pass on to you, B, to get us started.
Hey, listen, I'm here to make council elections interesting. I mean, the news media have been wetting their pants thinking it is interesting because Reform did really well. And they also notably did win a by-election against an incumbent Labour MP. So that kind of frames the Reform Party as like the official opposition to Labour, the government, right? Like, you know, the Conservatives couldn't beat them there, nor could the Lib Dems or the Greens, right? So Reform are now positioning themselves as an official party. And the media think that's really interesting. And look, I'll talk about the horse race and who won and who lost very briefly, but I think we can actually talk about some fun shit here. Like, I think we can actually make this exciting and also draw out some lessons for like us in our everyday lives and what we're going to have to do over the next few years, and also like for political strategy as well. But generally, so we don't all go absolutely balmy, let's just, you know, let's think about these things in a more fun and interesting way. So that's what I'm bringing today. You up for that? Yeah. Okay. That was a silent hand clap. So I'm having to get used to silent responses at the moment. It's dropping factoids off screen and no one was interested. So, okay. So, right. I mean, here's the basic, right? Labour is so shit, even Trump can't save them, right? Like, there's been something that's been called the Trump effect, which in Canada and Australia has saved these quite shit centre-left, really centre-right Labour parties, equivalent to the Labour Party, which is the Liberal Party in Canada and the Labour Party in Australia, who were both going to get voted out a couple of months ago in Canada by a massive amount. They were going to absolutely get panned, right? And it's turned around, you know, the leader of the Conservative Party in Canada lost their own seat. Australia, they've got a massive majority, not a massive one, but a significant majority by their standards, because they have a quite complex system with mandatory voting as well, which just wasn't supposed to happen. And mostly it's because people think Trump sucks. And if you're associated with Trump in our countries, generally in the Anglosphere, at least, and certainly in Europe, we're starting to see this as well, and other places, if you're associated with Trump, you must suck too. So like, that's been the big lesson that everyone's taken. But somehow Labour are so shit that like, even though Reform are massively associated with Trump, it's not enough to put people off voting for Reform because they just want change, right? And I think, you know, interestingly, when Vox Pops have been done and things have been talked about, people have been saying, you know, a notable thing they've been saying outside of the usual xenophobia and bigotry is they want change. They voted for change. They voted Labour for change. That hasn't happened. Labour have had enough time to do some change. And they say, oh, hold up, change takes time. It has to be incremental. Well, they didn't take you time to blooming cut winter fuel payments and, you know, cut disability payments and payments for like the working poor, right? That came like that. You could do that immediately. But like, proper change, that takes time. Like, things that makes your lives better, that's gonna, just stick with us, because that we've got to work on that. That'll just take a bit of time. Okay, cheers, mate. Yeah, great. So I think everyone has kind of got this understanding of Labour now. Very quickly, they've given the public a reason to think of them as anti-working class, anti-people, miserabilists who are not for change, who are also, by the way, incredibly boring at best and unappealing, you know, personally at worst. So people are like, nah, I can't actively support you. I mean, people barely actively supported them in this election. There were a couple of million votes off what Jeremy Corbyn did when he got wiped out, you know, like I think nearly 3 million votes off what Jeremy Corbyn did. That's a lot in a country as small as ours. So they weren't popular to begin with. They've got more unpopular. Rising up as the champions of change are Reform. Now, we shouldn't forget that like the Green Party have done well. And I think, you know, they made net gains of 79 council seats, which I think was really interesting. And also, excitingly for me, because I was down in Kettering and helped do their launch, Kettering managed to get 19 out of 20 seats on the town council, secured 8 seats on the Northamptonshire council, which is quite hard because that's a more county rural council. So they've done almost all of their targets. So they're smashing it. So the Greens are smashing it around the country as well. And there's a new potential leader in town, Jack Polansky, who's going to be speaking at the Media Democracy Festival, who's coming along and saying, yeah, we're about change and we need to just communicate that better. And I think that's true. And I think there's some interesting things to discuss there. If it's, I'm going to tee you up to talk about our boy, Zach Polansky, personal buds, because he's going to be speaking at the keynote at Media Democracy Festival. So do get on that May the 31st in London. You know, we've seen basically, even though it's a local election, the election has, instead of being for the incumbents, which has got way Australia and Canada has gone, it's been for change, and it's been for bigoted pro-Trump change, right? Like, that's apparently the lesson that we're supposed to draw from this. And I'm not entirely sure it is the lesson that we should draw from it, or at least I don't think that what we should be thinking about is getting involved in electoral politics to fight back against this. And I'll get into that in a tick. But first and foremost, what do you think of the assessment of what happened in the local elections, Chivers? Do you think, like, that, you know, broadly speaking, I'm right to say Reform, despite being associated with Trump, absolutely smashed it. And Greens did pretty well as well. And by the way, the third thing to point out is the Tories are screwed. Like, if Labour is screwed, the Tories are really screwed. Like, they're absolutely fucked. Do you think that's a fair picture?
Yeah, certainly. And I think what's sort of, you know, as you say, our feckless news media loves to latch on to, like, personalities and winners and losers stories and, like, oh, this is the election that Reform won, Labour lost, and the Tories may as well not have even played. But like you were saying, I think what's bubbling under both this local election and the last general election, and really all of the elections going back through, like, Brexit, 2014 parliamentary elections, 2015, 2010, is actually over time there's been a growing, but I mean, back in 2010, it was a sort of passive voting base, but it's much more active and much more vocal and much more concrete now. A voting base within this country that is, like, at a position of terminal decline, in the sense of, like, these are people who have seen nothing but their lives getting worse and worse and worse with every successive government, every successive election, every successive supposedly transformative national change, like, yeah, COVID or Brexit or Keir Starmer coming in or austerity. Like, 2010 was interesting because the government basically said, this is going to be the government of transformation, moving away from the broken past of the Labour government. However, we're going to cut all public services and massively shrink the state and usher in an era of, like, you know, they were saying it's basically austerity. It is an austere period where nothing's really going to happen and nothing's going to get better. And the poorest in society are going to have to tighten their belts for it. And that was sort of accepted at the time on the basis of, like, well, okay, yeah, Labour sold the gold and they burned the national economy and there's too many immigrants and blah, 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 blah. And basically, since then, every government, mostly Tory, but now Labour, have said things need to get worse to get better. And this is how we're going to front load everything we're doing. And this local election, I think, is, like, the first sign that that really, really hasn't worked. And it's only made things worse for the kind of voting base that you need to win in lots of these seats, which is a really kind of, you know, trivial and horrible way to look at it, because, like, yeah, these are people's lives who have suffered and people who have lost their winter fuel payment or know a family member who's lost their winter fuel payment. These are people who know that, like, there are lots of invisible disabilities or lots of people who claim, you know, the vast majority of people who claim disability living allowance are not doing so fraudulently, but doing so because of something that makes their life difficult or debilitating or gives them really difficult health conditions. So it's basically, I think that, you know, what's happened in this election is yet another sign that there are a huge number of people in this country who have seen nothing but decline in their own lives and have seen governments constantly try to explain to them, decline is good, this is what you deserve. But over here, the rich and the wealthy and the privileged can keep going on, you know, basically having their lives unscathed. So, and, you know, Reform are the current benefits of that process. Unfortunately, it's one of those things where you see people online sort of saying, oh, well, it's like with Trump, people say, oh, well, these people will be kicking themselves when Nigel Farage is prime minister and nothing good happens. And it's like, well, OK, you can't really just wait until the dictator comes in to tell people how stupid they were to vote for the dictator, right? You've got to mobilise now and be like, no, here is an alternative that's more positive and completely breaks away from this cycle of permanent decline that we've had over the last few governments, which is where I think Zach Polansky is interesting. And I think you saying, I'm good buds with him. I'm not good buds with anybody. I'm the most antisocial person you'll ever know. I don't really have good buds. I just have acquaintances who can tolerate me for sort of 20 minutes at a time. But, you know, I think what Zach Polansky, who is speaking at the Media Democracy Festival on the 1st of May, Saturday, free entry, come along. He's clearly set out a gambit both for the Green Party as a movement that I think lots of people recognise should be doing a lot better and should have a much clearer public presence and clout and power in what is happening in a lot of public conversations around politics. But also it's a gambit just for every political party of like, do you not see what's going on here? This has been a 15-year steady decline towards out-and-out populism in terms of just, we're not really proposing to do anything except one or two like blisteringly functional instrumental changes like, you know, repatriate all the immigrants or, you know, cut down the state, get rid of woke and DEI, which, yeah, is partly an import from the US. But is I don't think where the UK is different from Canada and Australia in that, you know, their electorate or most of their electorate appears to have resisted the appeals to Trump. I don't think that matters so much here because there's already within our national culture and within our national conversation so much parallel between what Trump has been offering in the US for the last 10 years and what reform or right-wing anti-immigrant parties have been offering here. So this is why I think, and also, you know, we can't put aside the fact that Keir Starmer has been actively sucking up to Trump. So you can't make a major political opposition in the Labour Party by opposing Trumpist movements when you yourself are teaming up with Trump and saying the same thing he does around government waste or tariffs being great or, you know, time to cut back on woke.
I want a little bit more context for the motivations behind why that is like strategic supposedly to the Labour Party.
I don't think we should worry about what Labour does. I don't think anyone should care. Labour are the government, right? The government manage the state. The state is acting in the state's interest. The reason it sucks up to Trump is because in particular, our secret services and our military industrial complex are completely and totally tied to the Americans. We couldn't fire our nuclear missiles without them. We couldn't basically fly our planes without them. We can't like launch our troops without them, right? So a state is, as we know, just organized violence, right? Like it's the monopoly on violence. Who gets to be violent, right? And without that, the state is nothing. So whoever manages the state, it doesn't really matter, conservative, reform, labor, green, like ultimately they have to manage the army and the police force. That's their ultimate responsibility. All the other stuff can go. But if you get rid of those things, you don't have a state. So all they're interested in is maintaining that power. And that's what they have to do. And they can't care about elections because, of course, in a liberal democracy, those are shams anyway. They're just performances that you do every so often. And the people who are directing the government to make decisions, which are the people behind the scenes, they don't care about who wins elections. Because as long as the next set of people who come in will do what they're told, and they have ways of making them do what they're told, it won't ever matter, right? Like, which is why, you know, first and foremost, the thing that I want to say is don't give a stuff. Don't get back into electoral politics. People forget this, that between 2010 and 2014, particularly 2013, what rose up against the Conservatives was a massive popular movement against austerity. And it was based in communities, but it was also had really hard-hitting communicators that broke through that said, this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong. And we fight against it. Had, you know, regular 200,000 person, 300,000 person protests each year. There was riots, there was other things, but also like strong community building. And then what everyone did was go, we need to, because we have a human need to see a horse race and see a winner, right? We need to get involved in some electoral movement. And so the first thing everyone did was get involved in the independence movement in Scotland and join the SNP, or I believe there was the Radical Independence Coalition, right? And they joined, like, they were like, and so many English people went up to Scotland during that time. And it's all we could talk about. Oh, Scotland becoming independent is going to change everything. It's going to be a big FU to austerity and we're going to create a utopia in Scotland, right? Right. And then that didn't work out. And so then everyone joined the Greens and there was what was called the Green Surge or the Green Wave about like, you know, and the Greens got like 1.5 million votes in 2015 and everyone was like buzzing for the Greens. And then Corbyn got elected. And so all those people then joined the Labour Party and everyone smashed their heads against the wall of the Labour Party inside of it, because being inside of a political party is, and it's designed this way, is incredibly demotivating and incredibly ineffectual, right? Like you never achieve anything. And during those years, as people moved out of the social movements and into the party and spent more and more of their time and energy fighting to win motions at local branch meetings, right? They stopped community organizing, they stopped making effective public messaging, they stopped doing actions, they stopped doing anything that was like what makes a social movement effective. And as they did that, the popularity for Corbyn decreased, right? And the popularity of his message decreased, right? Tie him up as well in a couple of knots around Brexit, which, you know, the liberals, the identitarian kind of liberals tried to divide the left with, said, hey, they really struggled to find a way to divide the left. And then they were like, hey, if you're for Brexit, you're going to execute it, then you're right wing, right? Like, and you know, they managed to destroy the movement that way, right? But it's been 5 years since Corbyn, and I think people have got short memories, and I think people are going to look at what's happened here and think, I need to get involved in the Greens, there needs to be an independent Labour Party or a new left-wing party, get the trade unions to join it, blah blah blah, right? This is the worst thing that you could be doing. This is a waste of time organizing, right? If you believe in liberal democracy, right, then think of it like a weather vane, right? It goes where the wind blows. And that's the best case scenario. In that situation, do you want to be the weather vane or the wind? You want to be the wind, right? And the example I've taken is from Politics 101. If you do a politics course at uni, that's how they describe the state. I don't believe liberal democracy actually works like that, but that's its best case scenario. And in its best case scenario, you don't want to be the ones trying to run the state. You want to be the ones shaping it, right? We cannot be effective inside an electoral party. You saw what happened to Labour people. You saw what happened to people in the Green movement. You saw what happened to people in the Scottish National Party, right? Like, they have to make lots of arguments for things they don't like. And you have to ultimately, if Corbyn had got in, by the way, would have had to implement lots of terrible things, right? Like he'd have had to. And of course, he'd have never been allowed in, but that's a story for another day. But let's say if we do believe in electoralism and we do want a progressive force to enter parliament, and that would be ideal. I'd love that. You know, I think we all would, even if it feels like daydreaming. The best way to get them there is to create the conditions for them to succeed outside of those parties, right? Like, we have to communicate clearly what we're about. We have to ignore reform. We have to stop talking about them. If we do talk about them, we say same old, mate. They're same old. They're just like the rest of them. You think, like, you know, billionaire bankroll private school kids are the ones that should be running this country. Not for me, mate. Like, but then don't say that's because you're for, because people come back at you, and this will happen on online debates, and they'll say, well, who are you for then? What, Labour? They've ruined this country, right? Like, the Conservatives destroyed it. What, Greens? They're woolly idiots, right? Like, you don't want to be on any of the teams. You don't want to be in the green team, the yellow team, the red team, the blue team, the purple team. You don't want to be on any of those teams. You go, no, I'll tell you what I'm for, mate. Wealth tax, nationalisation, you know, like us all having better lives. I want more arts, more culture, whatever it is. And it's take those messages and hammer them. It's not be on a team. Because, by the way, we've seen this. When Greens have got power, and they are, by the way, the most likely left-wing alternative in the electoral system, where they have got power, they've done things that have immediately wiped them out at the next election. It's the problem of being a junior coalition partner, which is all the Greens will ever be. And they've also made some stupid decisions. Like in Germany, they got rid of all the nuclear power plants. And that was insanely dumb. It absolutely screwed them when Putin invaded Ukraine and cut off the gas. Also, personally for me, it's a terrible focus for green policy, green energy policy. I think there are arguments against nuclear power. I don't agree with them. But even if those arguments are correct, it's a low order of priority. Your first priority in government shouldn't be trying to get rid of nuclear power. But again, we've seen it in Australia just now. The Greens got wiped out. Labour did well, Greens got wiped out, because ultimately you cannot maintain popularity. And now, if you've been standing for the Greens for the past 5 years because you said they're the only way to beat the far right or whatever, right? And then they've got in and everyone thinks they suck. Now you suck. You've ruined your, like strategically, it's the worst place to be. Tying yourself to the mast of someone else's party, or even joining that party and trying to shape it, it is an exhausting, pointless endeavor. It is charging at windmills. Don't do it. We've seen it fail so many times. Ad infinitum for 200 years. You've got to stop. And I know everyone wants to do it because it's an easy fix, but please stop it. Don't do that, right? Like, also, by the way, Zach, really enjoyed him. Good communicator, orally. He needs to put a suit on. Don't play the game if you don't want to play the game, right? Like, he needs to get a really good suit. People to this day still remember the fact that Corbyn didn't wear a good suit to begin with. And they never got past that. And in politics, in that kind of electoral politics, it's all about first impressions. You can't judge people for having emotional reactions to things. And whether you agree with it or not, if people think that you're badly dressed, they think it's because you disrespect them. You don't care enough about them and their opinion to make an effort. So make that effort.
What do you think, Shivers? Would you tell your acquaintance in the next 20 minutes that you have with them that they ought to
get some better suits?
They work I mean, on that suit game.
I show up to every meeting dressed as I am now, which is jogging bottoms and a t-shirt. So for me to start making dress code requirements of others.
You're not running to be leader of a national party, though, are you?
Not currently, no. I mean, I may be inspired by this chat.
If this podcast goes well. So I've not turned you off electoralism then?
I mean, you know, everyone's turned off electoralism. This is why thousands of people voted for Reform as the anti, you know, establishment party, even though, as you said, it is more establishment than most others. I was struck by, they interviewed the new Reform MP outside Parliament in their little crappy new MP rituals they do. And she was saying like, oh, I really, really love this. This is what I was born to do. And I think if any other MP in any other party had described themselves as being born to be an MP, they'd immediately be flagged out as like the most arrogant, like silver spoon little Tory boy for thinking like, oh, so you think you deserve to be in power and making laws? This isn't some, you know, power's not something that's owed to you. It's something that's lent to you by the public. And, you know, you have to, ideally, as Tony Benn said, you need to hand back the power you're given in each parliament to the public intact. So, you know, there's all these dumb, stupid contradictions. But I think, you know, in what you're talking about with electoralism, that idea of like, you know, it should be like a marketplace, right? Where you have all these different vendors coming to you saying, this is what I'm selling. Do you like it? And they have to follow the basis of like, well, if people want massive investments in green energy or they want to protect the rights of migrants or marginalized groups, then that has to be a strong enough expression from the voters, the customers. That has to have already been established through a mass movement of people to make that something to which parties want to appeal to get your vote. Because this is basically what Labour have said over the last, you know, 5 years is, we don't want the votes of the left. We actively do not want the left involved in this party. We do not want their votes. We do not want to attach ourselves to their issues or to their concerns because we think there's another electoral constituency somewhere else. And this now it's backfiring massively because like what they relied on traditionally is the sort of the default left vote or the, you know, the centre left vote in the country is recognising that this is a government that doesn't want to sell you the goods you're looking to buy. They want to do the exact opposite. They want to sell you the goods you've been avoiding buying for all of your life. So, yeah, I don't know. I am put off by electoralism because the whole approach of the party system and the way it's attached to the media apparatus and the state is obviously dysfunctional and failing and not in the interest of the general public. But it's what we've got to deal with because it's how people get power and get in control of the government. And yeah, making sure that there is, you know, we have a very limited time to try and redo the whole sort of spirit of the Corbyn project all over again, which is to create a mass movement that believes in very distinct things about social and political and economic change. And then not only creating that movement amongst ourselves, but then taking that movement to the wider public and saying, you know, the failures of the electoral system mean that all these things that are very popular are not happening. But they could, so come along for the ride. You know, that makes it sound very easy, but it's the basis of social and political change is having to go out and sell people the goods that they know they want but aren't currently being sold.
At which point I want to bring our attention back to what you were saying before, B, which is don't be the state, shape it. So what are our strategies to go about that?
Well, I think first off, actually, I'm going to pull Chivers up on something that he said earlier, which is describing Reform as populism. I think people have got to dump that term because populism is associated quite naturally with being popular and also like, and I think people quite like populism, left, right, any which way. It means change. If populists are bad, then I'm for it. You know, that's what people are thinking. That's not what I'm saying. You know, so I think we need to call a spade and say that they're authoritarians. Like what, you know, Farage wants to do is come in, destroy everything that would oppose him and make sure that he can do whatever he wants as in the most corrupt and venal fashion possible. Having said all of that, as I was saying, I think at the beginning, I think we've got two things to do. First off, let's work out what our messaging should be. And I'm just going to chuck this out there. And I want the audience to come back at us. I'm actually getting some great responses and that's cool. Let's talk about one, messaging, and two, like real world practical organizing for you and me every day in, day out. So in terms of messaging, I think we ignore the bigotry and the racism of reform. I think we generally ignore the topics like that they're talking to, unless it's one of our topics. There's two reasons for this. One, reform have already got who they've got. I don't know if you've spoken to a reform voter or anyone who's sort of become emboldened to be the worst version of themselves and now supports that kind of politics. You're not changing their mind, but they're still only at maximum 25% of the electorate. By the way, conservatives at their best, maximum 25% of the population rather than the electorate, maybe about 40% maximum of the electorate. And that's different because a lot of people don't vote. Our job is to get the majority on board with a different position. And you don't, there's no point in sort of trying to win those people over. First off, their minds are not for changing. Secondly, whenever you talk to one of their issues or even try and do something about it, let's say it's refugees or something like that, and it's either you try and win an argument with them about it or you say, no, you're right, we should do something about it. It doesn't matter. Either way, you're pressing the fear button. That's what happens. What happens in the brains and bodies of people that talk about migration or things like this in a dehumanizing fashion is they viscerally feel fear, and it shuts down a lot of the reasoning centers in their brain, right? And so when you talk about that stuff, there's no winning. There's no winning the argument. Also, often the way that people talk about it, they're just not equipped to argue on these points. They don't have the facts and figures, but also most importantly, they don't have the emotionally resonant arguments. And what people tend to default to is being snobby and demeaning and arrogant. Right? You're thick because you believe these things. People, by the way, don't really believe those things. They're feeling something and they're finding an expression. And they say they're like, I put huge amounts of money on the fact that you take any of these so-called racists, and if they weren't being bigged up and pushed to be the worst version of themselves, and you put them in a situation where they had to help out their common human, they would, without thought. Right. I think that's what you find, by the way, when you do these studies, that a lot of people that you think are the worst are actually kind of like the best in their community and stuff like that. So, but even if that wasn't the case, it's just not a good persuasion technique, you know, and I've talked about it before. And that's, you know, one of the reasons why I said early on a couple of months ago on this podcast that I think Farage will be the next prime minister, almost certainly. There's a couple of other reasons as well, international reasons. And we've got to kind of get used to that as well. We can't spend all our time hating a good deal of populace, right? We just can't live like that. That's not good for us. And again, it's just not strategically good communication. Like, it's not good use of our time. It's not good use of our energy for all the reasons that I've mentioned. You know, one, it won't get us anywhere. Two, we won't do it well. Three, we'll be indulging ourselves in fear and hatred, you know, which are like bad motivators. They don't keep us motivated. They keep us bleak. And that doesn't, you know, fourthly, make us good organizers with the people we need to be organizers with, which is everyone else. Like, that's who we need to get on board. And we need to, in terms of messaging, we need to look at people like Gary Stevenson, also known as Gary Economics, and hit one message and hit it hard and repeatedly. Wealth inequality is it all. I think maximum we pick three, but probably just one, and we just keep hammering it. The People's Assembly Against Austerity represented a movement of movements. There were so many. It was disabled people against cuts and queers against cuts. It was, you know, ethnic minorities and people on the dole and working poor and trade unions. And, right, like, it was the full panoply of the working class, and the majority in this country, right, were in some way tied into that. But it was a simple message. We're against austerity, right? So you take a simple message and you hammer it for years. And that becomes the thing that they have to speak to. And they have to, as Chivas says, they have to, when they come door to door selling to us, they have to be, that has to be then the number one pitch that they've got. Because we set that agenda, because we didn't let up. We had one clear message. So that's messaging. Don't talk about shit and rubbish, and don't try and persuade reform voters not to be reform. They're going to be. Focus instead on mobilizing everyone else around a core message or three max, right? That's messaging.
I mean, yeah, when I talk about like Farage and reform being populist, I mean that in quite an objective sense, in that that is the style of political movement they're running. I don't mean that in a disparaging way, because as you've just outlined, right, there is a populist case for left-wing policies, but currently, what we have in this country is a entire political and media complex, which has kind of buttressed up the appeal of a right populism based around all our problems come from immigrants. The solutions to all our problems are more authoritarian. punitive policies towards particularly immigrants, but also ethnic minorities, marginalized groups, disabled people, scroungers, the poor, people who aren't like you in a broad kind of Daily Mail, traditional Daily Mail sense of people who aren't like you, you know, white, lower middle class people who represent the backbone of Britain. Everyone is against you, and we need a populist movement to resolve these two or three problems. I think what's lurking behind that face of reform is the kind of revolutionary, like neoliberal, neoconservative movement, which the Tories kept trying to offer but couldn't bring themselves to really do it, which is properly shutting down the state, deregulating all of the basic public protections that exist in our society and our economy, putting all of the power and the wealth in the hands of the finance sector and the wealthy. That's sort of what's going on behind the reform movement. I think that, you know, the populist aspects of it, as you say, they are popular. Lots of people in this country want to reduce migration, rightly or mostly wrongly, on the basis of what we've had of 30 years of a media campaign against it. And that is what reform is seizing on to achieve their political goals. But their ulterior political goals are, as I say, what the Tories have failed to deliver. And it's why the Tories have collapsed, is because there are lots of members of the Conservative Party who do genuinely want more authoritarianism, more commercial market control over our lives, less of, you know, a smaller, if not a non-existent state. That's not what reform is really talking about at the moment. They sort of hinted it in some ways, like they've done in this council, in these council elections, where they've said, well, the first thing we're doing is we're sacking the DEI officers and we're, you know, taking control over what flags county councils can fly. So there's no more LGBT flags or no more European flags, or, you know, this sort of really basic, boring, but, you know, negatively populist kind of stuff, which is just a signal to say this is what we stand for. But what they're not talking about is what Nigel Farage has always wanted to do, which is to transfer power, wealth and influence to his friends in the city and the financial sector. So yeah, that's the kind of distinction of reform being a populist movement, is they're saying things that are currently popular but are not the solutions to people's problems as a way to get into power, to do the things that they and the hard right of the Tory party have wanted to be doing for the last 50 years.
Yeah, but what I'm talking about is the messaging rather than the semantics. Like, the problem is, like, when you've got Alistair Campbell and Rory Stewart out here talking about populism every episode of the biggest politics podcast in the UK, and you get like a load of sort of scared woolly liberals at home going, the populists are the problem. It means that everyone who is against those kinds of people, which is the majority of the country, right, now associates populism with a good thing. So what I'm trying to say is, in terms of messaging, I'm not saying that you're technically incorrect. You're absolutely correct technically, but I'm saying in terms of messaging, stop referring to them as populists, because you're making them seem, everyone is making them seem like the rebel insurgents, that, you know, oh, well, we're the populists who are going to come in and change things. No, you're an authoritarian scumbag. You're a Thatcherite, you know, of the worst order, who's going to cut everything up. Also, by the way, you know, essentially their messaging is, it was formerly just against immigration. Now it's against immigration and woke, right? But there's a third message that they're coming through, and I'm seeing it a lot from their chatbots and stuff that come into the comment threads, which is about waste, about government waste. They're like, the NHS could be run so much better if you just got rid of, you know, hundreds of thousands of people, staff, right? If we just cut all the funding out of it. Like, and people are parroting that. They're also saying, hey, we spend £80 million a day on refugees. We should be cutting that. That's government waste as well. So they start conflating these things. And that's going to form the bedrock of what Farage wants to do, right? Like, he's going to use immigration and wokeism to quote unquote cut waste, which is what he really wants to do, which is make a massive transfer of wealth to him and his banker buddies, and also consolidate power in his hands. Because once he's destroyed the elements of the state, which were the bits that essentially the working class and ordinary people won off the state, because as I say, a state is really just violence. It is just the army and the police, right? But all those other things that we associate with the state, those are things that we got as concessions. We said, we want a health system that works for us. We want nationalized industries that work for us. We want, you know, council services that work for us, right? When he takes them out of the hands of the state and puts them into a sort of autocratic, kleptocratic sort of situation where him and his buddies own it all, like Putin does, right? Like, and he just manages all the people who actually own all the things that we need to survive, right? That is the outcome of what he's driving towards. But as I say, when it comes to messaging, even though technically quote unquote, that is populist, it doesn't really do anyone any good, because I've just seen that just not land ever. And that's not landing not just with reform voters who are actually becoming more attracted to it, but it's also not landing with the people we want to mobilise, which is broadly everyone else.
On that matter of messaging and their second message, anti-woke, Chivers, I want to bring you in and move on to this second section, but still relevant section of the podcast. So,
well, I don't get too excited because it's not really an anti-woke thing. we were talking before, like, don't care, don't pay any attention to what the Labour Party's doing because it's attached to the state. But, like, you know, the political response of what the Labour Party does in response to events, particularly things like local elections, I guess, is interesting, if not important, because they are the government. And obviously the decisions they make will impact on people's lives, either immediately or over a much longer term in terms of how this country is shaped. One of the things we saw in the immediate aftermath of the election, which, you know, hasn't borne fruit yet, but could be an interesting sign of, like, the very wrong lesson, all the wrong lessons that the Labour Party will learn from these elections. None of the things we've been talking about, but all the things that play into the hands of, like, the risible minority of feckless, like, political media elite people who really do run the country and believe they should run the country and therefore all their decisions are golden perfect, is they've said, well, in order to show that Labour has changed and is listening and is learning from these local elections, what is it that's on everybody's lips? When you knock on the doorstep, what do people say they really want? Well, what they say is, we want to abolish the Department for Culture, Media and Sport. That's what everyone around the country is screaming and shouting for at the top of their lungs. And I mean, you know, this is just one of those rumours. I think it's just one of those rumours that gets thrown around in the press to get people talking about the internal politics of the Labour Party, rather than actually talking about what is our material response to this massive call from huge numbers of the members of the public saying, we don't like what you're selling and we're going to buy something else. But I think that response, and this is a very, very roundabout way of talking about it, but, like, this idea that tiny departments that get tiny amounts of public money to do things that are sort of valuable but broken, like regulation of media, regulation of gambling, providing access to culture, you know, for things like, you know, DCMS was set up by the Labour government in 2003 and it immediately achieved some, like, really transformative things that sit at the bedrock of our country, like free access to museums or wider public participation in sport or the Olympics, which, say what you want about, like, the horrible presentation of the Olympics and all the disgusting corporate interests that were involved in it. For a time, people were suddenly very interested in getting involved in sport. And there's a whole generation of children in this country who were, like, actively encouraged to get involved in sport in their local communities because of us hosting the Olympics. That was something that was achieved by the last Labour government wanting to have, seeing that there was a public benefit of investing in and caring about sport and culture and public participation in society as a public good. So it's really interesting that, like, Labour's response to these local elections is, we need to get rid of the Department of Fun and Games because the minimal amount of millions of, I think it's the cheapest government department. It costs the least amount of money because a lot of it, what it does isn't like having control over the levers of the economy or steering major parts of the industry. It's just a sort of a department of people making decisions about how should we access culture or what should be the regulation of the media. But I do wonder, the reason why this was floated is because Morgan McSweeney, the puppet master behind Keir Starmer, the man who, like, created the anti-Corbyn movement and lied to the British public and led to this situation where everyone's now noticing the Labour Party lied to you and isn't going to deliver for your interests. I think he is taking from the Trump playbook of, like, well, people really like talking about waste and things that don't, you know, they want their money to be saved and they don't like woke stuff. So if we get rid of the wokest, most wasteful sounding department, that'll be good. But there are parallels with what's happening. Like, there's a sign of what happens when you do that in the US, where Trump has been embarking on this, like, direct crusade against public media in the US over the last few months. Without getting into the details, public media in the US, as in media that is funded, publicly owned or publicly funded and does things for a public purpose, is, like, a massive shadow of what we have here in the UK. It doesn't have a big national organization like the BBC. The America doesn't even have, like, basic public regulations on commercial media, although it did up until the 1980s. And I think since Trump's re-election, there's been a coordinated MAGA assault against, one, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which is the sort of the government funding body for public media. And there's been a massive MAGA assault against the two major public media networks over there, which is PBS, Public Broadcasting Service, and NPR, the National Public Radio. So we've had, like, First of all, we had Elon Musk like attacking National Public Radio in his kind of Doge crusade, saying it was wasteful and needed to be shut down. In March, we had everyone's favourite crackpot Republican Marjorie Taylor Greene hosting like a ritual humiliation session in Congress where she summoned the heads of NPR and PBS to tell them how disgustingly woke and radical left and propagandizing they are and why they should be shut down. And now just in the last few weeks, we finally had the sharp end of the stick where Trump has signed an executive order directly ordering that the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which is like the partly government-owned body, the executive order says that that corporation should immediately stop funding NPR and PBS. So the president has said, stop giving them money. And then at the same time, the White House is also saying they want to stop giving money to the corporation itself. So not only is it like an executive order saying we're defunding the two public media networks, but also we are defunding all of the thousands of other smaller like community radio and TV stations which get public money from the corporation. So this is like just overnight, Trump has defunded public media in the US, which kind of doesn't sound too drastic when public media in the US is so tiny and so moribund and nothing compared to what we have over here. But I think it's swathed in this sort of broader MAGA argument that going woke isn't just bad for American liberty and values and democracy and blah, blah, blah. But crucially, that going woke is wasteful and that government money shouldn't be going to minorities or to LGBT issues. We shouldn't be using the government to regulate against market failure, shouldn't be using the government to stop harm to the public through like waste in the sewers or through like crap in the media environment. Shouldn't be using the government to protect the public interest in any areas of public life. And all of that is basically just the government interfering in the glorious, perfect functioning of the commercial marketplace, which is a long way of me looping back to the UK and saying, I think this is, we've started both in this kind of rumour of abolishing DCMS, but also in some of the other stuff that's been coming out of the Labour Party recently. Like, you know, government ministers actively talking about we need a Doge department in the UK. We need a department of government efficiency, which is all about just scrapping regulations, getting rid of wasteful impediments in the marketplace. It's the only way to encourage growth is by scrapping like basic public interventions in the market or in society or in culture. So I don't know, that's a sign from the US of what it looks like when the government just uses its power to immediately intervene and destroy things which do have a public purpose. And I find it very, very interesting that this is what we've heard from the Labour Party of all parties, which is like, no, that sounds like a really good thing to just immediately like jump into some of the core foundations of how our country has been run for the last 30 years and just say, now we're getting rid of that, we're selling that, we're scrapping that. Whether DCMS will go, you know, there won't be any love lost from me if DCMS does go. But the alternative isn't any better because, like, okay, does that mean we're going to get rid of free entrance to museums? Does that mean we're going to get rid of all these public regulations on broadcasting? I don't know, but it's sort of an interesting sign of how is Labour reacting to these elections by directly copying some of the, like, underlying language and motivations behind MAGA. And it probably won't go very well for them, despite them thinking that this is, you know, it's what's coming up on the doorstep. People want to get rid of DCMS. That's how we'll win back their votes. Maybe not.
Immediately, my instant thought was like, what a bureaucratic way to go about this notion of like efficiency by introducing something that I know will be so incredibly inefficient in and of itself. Hilarious.
And unnoticed as well.
Right.
No one in their right minds is going to notice this has happened. So it will have done them absolutely no good, except for that it will tear at those fundamental things that we need as a society to feel coherent and cohesive.
Yeah, I fucking love the fact that I can go to a museum for free. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
That shit goes so hard. Like, what?
Yeah, because here would be the
like,
sort
that's
of the...
where you want to be when you're tripping on acid. Like, you don't want to have to pay. You have to think, I'll cut that out.
No, but you don't want the BBC to be Netflix, by the way, because you don't want to, like, I was reading a book recently called The Retention Point, where like Netflix, what it does is it works out that if you watch to a certain point in a program, you will watch the whole series, like it, over a program and a half. It's usually about halfway through episode two or something like that. And then they've got you. So then they try and sort of manufacture and engineer getting you to that retention point earlier, like trying to like just get you addicted. And it shows you the sort of vacuousness of like a private enterprise creating culture, right? Which is like, we're just going to try and create the most addictive stuff that we can. And by the way, they're doing badly at it. Like, people are more and more like turning off from it, because ultimately when you make stuff that's candy floss that has no substance, it kind of grosses people, they get their fill. at some point and they go, oh, it kind of grosses me out. I don't want any more of it. You're seeing it with social media and other things. So you want a universal service that's meant to be for everyone, right? That actually tries to do something of value for every community, because you get things that you wouldn't otherwise have got, things that you never thought of. And the BBC has been turning away from this for a long time, but during its height in the 60s, 70s and 80s, certainly before it's getting destroyed, and even to a less extent the 90s, you know, the amount of working class culture that was seen, British working class culture, which had not really had a voice before, found its expression in things like the BBC and other things like that, to become global phenomena, right? But also, you know, now when I'm talking about like what the working class or growing up in certain communities are like, I can point to this era and say, this is what it looked like to live coming from my time. And I think you'd struggle to do that now, because the BBC is turning away from what it's doing and trying to chase those commercial services. But that's the problem of like trying to chase profit or not just profit, because obviously that's what Netflix is doing, but chasing the way that they do things. And what was good about PBS and NPR in the US is it tried to provide things for communities that otherwise wouldn't. It created Sesame Street. And if you listen to NPR radio programming, it's fantastic. It's genuinely, you know, it's not quite Radio 4 levels, but it's close, you know. And I think all of our lives are poorer for that. And that gets felt. It gets emotionally felt. You know, I was talking about messaging. Like, it gets felt in a way that people can't put a finger on it. So they'll never hear that this happened, right? And they'll never know why. And it'll have gained Labour no popularity whatsoever. And at the same time, what they need for any hope of success is like a feeling from people, not even like a logical knowledge or whatever. They need both material reality to be better, right? Like, which is what the trade unions, people like Eddie Dempsey, talk about all the time. They say, we think too much about the brain stuff and we're not thinking about like what's in people's bellies. And I think that's true. And they've got to address that, but also they've got to address how people feel. And if you don't have a ministry for fun and games, like that elevates us and brings us together, then they're going to destroy the foundations of their very minimal success, right? And that is the bit that will be felt. You know, and just one final point that, like, when Chivers was talking about, like, Marjorie Taylor Greene, who is an absolute balm cake, and that's the nicest thing I'll ever say about her, because she deserves to be described as far, far worse. What's fascinating is she will ask these bizarre, stupid, cretinous questions in Congress when she's pulling people up in front of her thing. And then she'll get rebutted in response and it will make her look stupid. But that's not what her supporters see. And that's not what like MAGA people see. MAGA people see a completely different set of reality. And the important thing to note about that is, and this comes back to what I wanted to say about messaging, the second thing we have to change is the communication system. How we get to people. Because we can change the message all we like, but if we're playing on the playing field that someone else has created, then we're never going to win. We have to have methods of reaching and talking to each other. And that's why I encourage everyone here to support Media Reform Coalition, to support media reform efforts, to support what we will launch eventually as a public media fund, right? Unless we have ways of communicating, a method, a system, it doesn't matter, because all MAGA supporters are going to see is a TikTok where she slams the libs. The woke libs, and her thing will be seen and the response will not be, or it'll be edited so that you see the response of someone go, you know, choking on their words or whatever, right? So you can never reach those people unless you have a different communication system, because the message will never matter. It doesn't matter if I see countless American commentaries slamming Marjorie Taylor Greene. It's, you know, it's gonna matter at the edges, and fair play to people who do that. But ultimately, if it's on a platform like YouTube, for instance, which is owned by Alphabet, the biggest technology firm in the world, that it's really close to the presidency and is determined to see it succeed, you're not going to get to those people. So we have to work out another way. And that comes to my very final point, which is that means we need to get people together in the same spaces. We've lost that. We've lost the pub. We need to start creating new places where people can just rub shoulders against each other and rediscover what it's like to just be around each other, you know? And that would be a core of our success, alongside a lot of quite technical solutions that we're going to try and work on. We need to just spend time in each other's space. And that's going to be difficult because we're all still post-pandemic going, I quite like being by myself.
I'm so glad you said that because you're gonna be proud of me. Because yesterday, guess what I did yesterday?
What did you do?
I watched the game. Barca versus Inter.
This is Inter Milan. Incredible game. You watched the best game in human history.
I literally did though. I literally did though.
you've got to watch all the games because you'll make them amazing.
I was there with like the only white friends I have. And that tells you about why I was in the pub to begin with. But I was with another friend as well. And I love it. I love being around these boys. They're very endearing. They're very endearing boys.
I'm sure they love hearing themselves described as that. And I would too. I live for the day to know that behind my back, you've described me as endearing.
Endearing, yeah. I mean, that's the only way I can really describe them, I think. And I think it's a good way to describe them as well. I mean that with love and love only. But that whole game, like, I don't think I've ever been captivated by football so much. Like, I don't think I've ever felt any inkling towards giving a fuck ever. And during that game, I'm just sat there like so invested. Like, because I think at earlier in the night, I'd said to one of my friends, I was like, the thing about football is that it's kind of like boring until it's really interesting.
Yeah.
And I, that's how I feel about it. But that whole game. So yeah. I was like, you couldn't take your eyes off the screen.
Yeah. Well, that's
Last night are the reward for following hours and hours of boring, shitty football, right? Is if you're lucky enough to have just been in the pub with your friends when that match plays, you are deceived into thinking, well, actually, football's really good. I'm going to watch it all the time. And within 2 weeks, you're like, no, it's as shit and boring as I always thought it was.
That place was packed. There was people really committed with their shirts, obviously, with the fact that, like, they had their chance. There was like, you could tell there was a, they had to be Spanish.
They were Barca fans.
And they were, yeah, absolutely. And they were screaming their lungs off. It was like, I don't actually think that's a phrase, but point is they were screaming loud as hell. And it was, oh, this is how men, you know, this is how men.
This is how men get their fix, you know, of being a human, right? Like of being in community or like, you know, community is about joy. It's also about boredom. Like, that's something we've got to learn to embrace. And football's a perfect encapsulation of that. It is genuinely, it's quite a boring game punctuated by these moments of extremely high drama. Like, and that's bad refereeing decisions and offsides, disallowed goals. It's, you know, heavy
tackles. I love this shit.
Drawing a square in the air, we now all do. We've got universal hand signals, you know, right? And it develops a shared language, right? Like, I remember when I traveled when I was 20 and I could travel the world. And at that point, most people around the world didn't speak English or anything like that. So it would be very broken, a conversation, but you'd like, I like football. And they'd be like, okay, where are you from? Right. And they get a little thing. So it's this shared global experience that, again, you get to have at World Cups. If you're Scottish, the beautiful thing is you can support two teams, Scotland and whoever's playing England, which is beautiful. Like, I think it's great to have like rivalries like that, but you can just enjoy seeing also the cultures of people expressed through a game. But mostly you can go to a place with all your mates and spend time with them singing and being really actively involved, or just chatting and gossiping and then going, oh, you know, and like something like, what was that? You know, like, so you can have those experiences and we need to have them together. And, you know, again, when we come back to the method of a communication system, one of the fascinating things that's happened to football and one of the saddest is that the profit-seeking nature of those who own it has, they've done everything they can for 30 years to dull that, to take that out of it as much as possible, to sanitize it and make it as beige as possible. And they can't yet, not fully. It has less of an experience than it was of community, but it still can't stop the fact that when Newcastle won the League Cup recently, everyone in the city of Newcastle will have lost their minds for days. Right. And that Liverpool, like an entire city, was partying 4 days because they won the league. It, you know, in Milan, half the city is going to lose its minds. Like, it's a shared cultural experience at a level that, you know, we yearn for. And when we talk about, again, you know, messaging, I'm saying what we ignore, what we celebrate, what we organize around, what we champion. Is this these shared moments, these shared moments of both extreme excitement and boredom, as long as they're together. You know?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Who do you share moments of extreme excitement and boredom, Chivers?
God, what a horrible question to stun on me at the end of a podcast. Oh my God, that's like existential. Who do I spend my time with?
Lonely goblin.
I don't know.
What do you and your acquaintances get up to these days?
Well, look, you know, I live down in the back end of the country with not many like real life friends nearby. I've got my lovely wife and my lovely baby who we do lots of stuff around the beach and stuff here. But then when I'm like watching football, I'm actually watching it online with a group of gaming friends who I've known for like nearly 2 decades. Yes. And I'm having the same experience of being in the pub, except I'm sat here with people on a voice chat and we're just having the same stupid banter and shouting at the screen as anyone else would. I think, you know, that's something which lots of people are doing now, which probably has like deeper social implications, but that's how I do it. I do the same thing but online.
I think it's good because I've got friends who are around the world, but we all grew up together, and my friends now that I've known for 30 years, which is a long friendship, and it's maintained now by a Sunday afternoon game, right? Like, that's a pretty much guaranteed at least once a fortnight, usually once a week. Whatever's the Sunday afternoon game, we watch it. At least someone, because we've got a variety of different fans, will have something in the game, but we play fantasy football. But to take it out of a WhatsApp chat, you're all on there. And because the game, as you say, like as we've noted, is generally not huge amounts happening, we're chatting and catching up on each other's lives, you know, shared hopes, dreams, experiences, like losses, and just mostly random shitty banter, right? And being a human for a bit, punctuated by like, oh, and then arguing about whatever happened there. There's this beautiful, like, you know, that Bob Mortimer and Paul Whitehouse Go Fishing BBC show. I don't know if you've seen it, but like, there's a beautiful little moment in it where they're both fishing. They're looking away from each other. And Bob Mortimer's talking about like how his friend, who's quite old now, is going back to all the places he used to live and frequent to collect a sort of bag of memories. And it's really beautiful. And it's a beautiful thought. And then Paul Whitehouse, in response, sort of talks about like how actually you want to live in the moment to get the most out of life and not let the past drag you back. And they sort of have this kind of, you know, it's sort of a very gentle disagreement about like your perspective on life. The way they do it is by at no point looking at each other. They're both looking out into the street so that they don't overwhelm each other with each other's like emotions and emotional expression. And so they can contemplate and go back and forth. And that's often what we get with football. It's like, we're not looking at each other. It's not like a date. I'm not looking you in the eyes and telling you like what's happened. But like, you know, I can gently drop that like I'm not in a great place right now whilst we're all looking at the match. And then my mate can put his hand on my shoulder and go, you know, but we're not looking at each other. Do you know what I mean? And maybe that's...
No eye looking. That's too gay.
Yeah, maybe it's a confused British repressed thing. I don't know. Maybe that belongs in Pride and Prejudice. But at the moment, that's how we're doing it. And I'm just saying I'm here for that celebration. And it's those things that we can get. Again, I think we can have those things around Married at First Sight Australia and Love Island. I think I now live watch reality TV shows with my friends, right? And we gossip about it as it happens. I think there's many ways that we can share these things. Those are the things. We've got to be for something, not just against something. That's why I say ignore that stuff, that noise that they're making. Because if we're the ones having fun and bringing people together and experiencing something together, and we stand for something great, like, that will coalesce into something that will get reflected electorally and in other places. That will spread throughout society. And we will find ways, by the way, by being together and talking about things, going, we really need to do something about this, and we'll get on it. You know, but it starts with like those shared moments. You know what I mean?
Yes, it does. So go to the pub, get into football, get into Love Island, and like start to own the things that you love.
And join a news club.
And join a news club
when we get them set up.
All right. Well, thank you guys for joining us today. Thank you, you guys, for speaking today. And we will catch you next week.
Sweet.
Thank you. Bye-bye.